Next up to the podium, Peter Kolomitsev, who is presenting a paper that's co-written by himself, Beth Robertson and Silver Moon, who couldn't be here today. Peter has been an audio professional for a long time. I like this. In fact, some say he was born with headphones on. Yep, you do, indeed. He is now working in the area of audio preservation at the Library of South Australia. And I like this. There's another hyperbole, has seen success and failure. So I think I will let you read Beth and Silver's biogs. Don't tell them I didn't introduce them, Peter, will you? Peter Kolomitsev.
Hello. I think I feel a little bit out of place because what I'm going to be talking about is not anything to do with gaming or the internet or computer or anything like that. So, there's a lot that's perhaps a parallel universe and. In a way, I think the audio world has made a lot of groundwork in preservation over the years, and sort of set out the way a lot of people are approaching things. So, I think it's vaguely relevant. So, without further ado, I'll bang on. So, at the State Library of South Australia, we've got a large audio collection, and they're in various formats. And they're both analog and digital, and they include all sorts of stuff like wax cylinders, lacquer discs, open reel tapes, cassettes, and in the born digital material, we've got things like digital audio tape, DAT, a mini disc, and what I'll be mostly speaking about, today, is compact disc. An interesting thing that I've been seeing with a lot of talks today is it's a lot of quite cutting edge stuff in the way people are dealing with things, and when compact disc came out, it was sort of seen as the future, and now it's really very much the past. Anyway, the content in the collection, it's as varied as the format. So we've got things like oral history, ethnographic field recordings, various archival record groups, which have all sorts of licorice, all sorts. And significantly for compact disc, particularly compact disc digital audio, that original format, is the published audio collection. And the published audio collection is largely driven by our legal deposit legislation in the state. But we've also got a fairly active collection development team who seek out to find those items that don't get deposited and sort of fall through the cracks. In terms of reformatting at the State Library, we've actually had quite a long history of it. Sort of it goes way back to the 80s, and the initial program was all done to analog tape, and it was literally done out of a cupboard. And there's a photograph from 1987, yeah. In 2003, the library underwent a major building redevelopment. As part of that, we had two studios that were assigned as two rooms that were assigned as audio studios. 2004, we began digitally preserving the audio collection, and that was with the purchase of a CubeTech Quadriga system. And I was also employed at that same time to implement the program. So over the years, we've developed the two rooms from basic office spaces with a bit of a gear shoved in it, no acoustic treatment, no soundproofing, and up until now, we've got two fully-fledged studios that are soundproofed with bespoke acoustic treatment throughout it and quite a lovely space to work in. There's two of us working in the area, And we're not just responsible for reformatting legacy material, but also material that's coming into the collection, as well as maintaining our oral history program and providing technical support for that. So the overall collection is really quite large, and it grows by hundreds of hours per year. And because it spans across multiple formats, and our resources are fairly limited, we need to make decisions about what gets reformatted and when. And we use a decision tree approach, and that sort of takes into account things like the vulnerability to degradation and damage, and the stability of the various formats, as well as equipment obsolescence, loss of technical expertise, as well as cultural significance of the individual items and their uniqueness as well, and particularly their uniqueness. So if we have one copy of something and it's culturally relevant or significant and it's in danger, that will be the first sort of cab off the rank when it comes to choosing what we digitise. And that's precisely the sort of approach that pretty much most collecting institutions make, I think. And so when putting this paper together, I started thinking about where does compact disc audio sit on that decision tree approach. And I think it's been traditionally fairly low down. I mean, most people traditionally have considered CDs to be an indestructible format that, you know, will last forever and be perfect sound forever. And this cover from a CD that I believe was distributed with Philips' first generation of CD players, I think says it all. Pure, perfect sound forever. There's some knowing laughs there. And more recently with recordable CDRs, they've been marketed with things like archival grade and having a 100-year life or a, you know, lifetime guarantee, those sorts of things. And that's also fed that perception that they're a permanent item. And then you add to the fact that when they're played, there's very little physical contact, unlike on a vinyl disc or a tape. So that sort of added to that view of indestructibility. And that, I think that seemed to have permeated the preservation policy around the world. And this quote from a study into the longevity of optical media makes that sort of view fairly clear. Yeah, indeed. The presumed potential to last indefinitely, since they are not subjected to the same wear and tear as other recording media. And obviously, we've all experienced that sound of the skipping CD or the DVD, because that's a similar sort of technology that will freeze, or data discs, CD-ROMs, that will have corrupted data on there and no longer be usable. So clearly, it's not as safe a format. To understand what the potential problems are for long-term storage of compact discs, I think it helps to know a little bit about the way that they are made and what exactly they are. So you can split them into two areas, two camps. There's your manufactured disc, which is more technically known as a replicated disc, which is that sort of thing that you'll... That sort of thing is a pretty terrible photograph. iPads. Not very good camera. Your recordable disc, the CDR and CDRWs. And the library's collection holds both replicated discs and recordable discs. The replicated discs, the one that I showed before, that's the sort that you tend to go into. You go into JB Hi-Fi or a shop like that and buy, you know, your latest releases, Lady Gaga or Metallica or, you know, Beatles reissues, those sorts of things. You know, they come with a cellophane wrapping and and they've got the liner notes, all that kind of gear. And your CDRs, CDRWs, obviously your usable, writable, they're user writable, and the material that we find on them in our collection is those one-off recordings, really short production runs, band demos and, you know, homebrew recordings, just sort of to parallel some of the talks yesterday. And these are the sorts of things that bands would publish, self-publish and sell through gigs and those sorts of things. So clearly, we can see on that decision tree, these items start falling into that fairly unique category. The basic construction of a replicated disc is your 120mm polycarbonate disc, and they're coated with a reflective metal, which is generally aluminium, and then coated with a protective layer to protect that reflective layer, and then they have some sort of printing on it. In the top layer of the polycarbonate, there's a spiral series of tiny moulded indentations called pits, and this is a really lovely photograph that I nicked off of Wikipedia, showing the pits. And the area between the pits are called lands, and that basically holds your audio data, or, you know, any kind of data on there. And the way that it works is the laser shines on there and gets reflected back differently, and representing the ones and zeros in a very simplistic way. Explanation. Okay, and to create your replicated disc, it's a very industrialized process. It begins with the creation of a glass master, and those pits are written to that disc with a photochemical process, and the glass master's electroplated, and that creates a stomper. And then through an injection moulding process, they get the polycarbonate discs are made, and that's coated with your reflective layer, and then printed on, generally screen printing. So as you can see, it's such an involved process that it requires minimum runs, and that's sort of generally in the order of 500 to 1,000 discs. So they've become a lot more of a common thing. CDRs and CDRWs, they're obviously the same size disc, and they're similarly laminated, so you've got those layers once again like that. But instead of the pits written into the polycarbonate, there's basically a blank groove, and sandwiched between the polycarbonate and the reflective layer is a photosensitive dye of one form or another. And in order for the data to be written, the laser in the CD writer will quite literally burn the pits into the dye. Another thing to understand about the way that compact disc works is error correction, or error detection and correction. And it may be something of a surprise that pretty much most CDs have errors on them. They're imperfect. And it's remarkable that we actually don't hear them as a series of glitches and dropouts and whatnot. And that's because of error correction, and it's cross-interleaved Reed-Solomon coding, CIRC. And sort of, in a sort of simplified explanation of it, it sort of has a couple of bites at the cherry and looks at what the errors are and then interpolates them. And those sorts of things can be measured. I won't really go much into that because I don't really have much time. And those errors over time, particularly with compact disc recordable, will start to increase. And that's a clear sign of degradation. And beyond those inherent manufacturing faults, there's other things that can happen to them. They can start getting scratched. They get dirty, have fingerprints on them. And that's generally sort of physical handling errors, but then they also, there's also the materials will start breaking down, and that can be sort of things like the metal layer will begin to oxidize, and you'll see that as things like, oh, I forgot about that one. The other thing that can happen to them is the reflective layer can get scratched and damaged, and clearly once that's happened, they're not going to work because the laser has got nothing to reflect off of. And that metal layer can, as I was saying before, can oxidize, and you'll see that as, I'm not sure if you can really see it with this photograph, but particularly with the older replicated discs, if you hold those sort of silver discs up to the light, you often see little pinholes in them, and that's caused by oxidisation. Or they may just go a brown colour called bronzing. There's a particular batch of English replicated discs that were really synonymous with that problem. And with the CDRs, the dyes chemically degrade. They break down. They're being photosensitive. They're susceptible to UV damage as well. And the life expectancy for CDRs is really quite short. You know, 10 years less, 2 years, depending on the quality, and particularly with the really cheap ones. I wouldn't trust them beyond 6 months. And once those errors start happening, that's when you start getting uncorrectable errors, and you'll start hearing glitches, dropouts, pops, and skipping audio, as well as complete disc failure. Some discs will just, you put them in a player and they will not play. And that obviously brings into question that long-term stability of the compact disc. So, as our library holds many of these unique recordings, because of their cultural significance, this is the musical output of a few generations of South Australian musicians and composers, and with the CDRs, like I said before, it's short run stuff, so one offs and low run discs. So there's not many of these items. And we may well have the only one available. So with all of this in mind, the fact that we know that they're degrading with time, that they're culturally significant and often unique, we decided that it was time that we addressed them and underwent a reformatting program. But unfortunately, when the discs were originally catalogued, the cataloguers didn't define whether they were replicated discs or CDRs, and that's partially, I suppose, because they may well have not known the difference, but also I think there was, once again, that perception that they were forever. So there wasn't any need to make much of a statement about the technical quality of the discs. So with the first step that we've had to do is to do a survey of the entire collection. And with that survey, we went through and identified the replicated discs, the manufactured discs, what were CDRs, what were CDRWs. But we also looked at the manufacturers. So with CDRs, CDRW, that was the manufacturer of the blank. And obviously with the replicated discs, it was the pressing plants. And we also noted things like the dye colour, because the different dyes can be seen in a different colour, and the varying different dyes have different sort of life expectancies. We also noted the reflective layer colour, if we could tell, and a few other things like with the type of printing on the disc, as that can affect the longevity of the disc. So whether they were screen printed, bubble jet, or whether they had a sticker. I don't know if you remember, people used to stick stickers on the discs. You get the little round stickers with a stomper, and they can have really detrimental effects to the disc as well as handwritten discs. And we also noted the shape and the size. So you can also get, as well as the 120mm disc, you can also get 80mm discs, as well as there's a few little novelty shaped discs that you can get. And knowing that sort of information is handy because they won't play in certain players, so we'd need to know that information. Here's some stats for those who are interested in stats. So it's a reasonably large collection, not the biggest in the world, but, you know, it's certainly sizable. And so there's about 1,200 CDRs. So the initial survey has laid that groundwork for our full-scale reformatting program, which we're going to begin with that 1,200 CDRs and the CDRW as well, the three CDRWs. I was actually really happy to find that there was only three of those because they are probably the most susceptible to loss. I haven't really talked about those, but I won't. So for our purposes, which is the long-term preservation of these CDs, we need to accurately and faithfully reproduce or reformat those original discs. And to do that, you can't just stick the disc into your computer and rip it using iTunes. So the process which is called digital audio extraction, or more commonly, ripping, isn't particularly accurate. And here's a few reasons why. Probably one of the main reasons is that error correction, which I spoke of briefly before. And your traditional CD player, which in itself is becoming something of a rare beast, fully implements that Reed-Solomon error correction. CD-ROM drives will all do this to varying degrees and often not at all, and they will leave it to the software. And the software doesn't always do it either. And that sort of leaves that potential for errors and glitches and whatnot. Another issue is the way that many extraction programs handle the track information. And the track markers, they're held in what's known as the subcodes, which is non-audio codes on the disc, which are defined as letters P to W. And the track markers themselves are probably the most used of those codes, and that's the P and the Q codes. And they, once again, simplistically speaking, they define the track start and end points as well as the gaps. And that gap is nominally, according to the CD, the Redbook standard, which is the CD standard, is nominally 2 seconds. But it's rarely the case. And when CDs are mastered, that space might be longer or shorter depending on the mood of the music. And there may also be audio placed within that gap. And that's particularly common in things like live recordings and DJ mixes. And there's also another thing known as the pre-gap, which is a gap prior to the first track on the disc. And once again, that's normally a couple of seconds of silence. You don't really hear it. You put the disc in and it plays straight from the beginning of track one. But you can extend the length of that gap and hide audio in it. And that's a sort of like an Easter egg kind of thing, and that's known as hidden track one audio. And there's a huge number of discs that have that hidden audio in there. And the way that you play that track is by sticking it in. Well, when you stick it in a traditional audio player, you press play, starts playing track one, and you press the skip back button, and you skip back before the first index point, and then you get your hidden track. But in computers, the ROM drives in computers don't always support that, because technically that extended audio in that pregap is outside that Redbook standard. So they don't necessarily need to support it. And so if the... And the ripping, and most ripping software doesn't support it at all either. So you'd be losing those bits of audio. And the subcodes can also contain things like CD text, which is those the information about the artist names and track titles, album names, etc. So a lot of rippers won't support that, won't extract that data. So currently, we're in a situation where we're trying to figure out what ripping system, what digital audio extraction system to use. So we've obviously got a few things that we need to make sure that it does. It needs to support the audio standard, which is 16-bit 44.1 linear PCM, two channels, stereo, as well as it needs to capture the disc as it appears, the audio as it appears on the disc, and that's including the gapping, the size of the gapping, any audio within that gap, the pre-gap audio, if it's present. It needs to be able to do the error correction properly, obviously, and preferably be able to log any uncorrectable errors, so we know that there may well be a problem. And finally, it needs to capture the subcodes, and particularly the P and Q codes, as well as your CD text if it's present. We haven't really come to a decision on that. We're leaning towards another CubeTech product, as it pretty much fills the bill, but it's expensive. The final product of that digital audio extraction, we need to be able to retrieve it as well, and as accurately and close to the original disc, a disc image. So we also need to be able to store those disc images so we can recreate it well into the future. That's a bit of a curly question, and I still haven't figured that one out myself. There's a few things that you can do. You can store it as a what's known as a DDP, which is the format that mastering studios will send to the replication plants. It's well supported in that industrial area, but it's not a common format. It's also proprietary, which is sort of a bit of an anathema to preservation, is anything that's proprietary. So I'm still nutting that one out. There is, I suppose, relevant to this conference, there's with audio, the audio archival community, there's been quite a long-standing tradition of archival support amongst the community. So there's the International Association of Sound and Audiovisual Archives, with the most inaccurate acronym on the planet. And they've been around for decades, Samar?
Well, CCA4 is 10 years ago, so...
Yeah, which is that book there, yeah. So, and they've been basically doing what we've been doing for years, having regular conferences, and to lay down various standards across all the audio formats. Not so much standards, but guidelines. I think they're pretty clear to say guidelines.
And video
as well. Yeah, that's right. That's why they've had to wedge in that extra audio-visual bit to make the acronym inaccurate. Anyway, enough of that. For me, this whole project has been quite interesting. Having been a really active part of the recording industry in South Australia since the very early 90s, a lot of the material in the collection I've, in one way or another, had dealings with, either through producing it myself, including stuff I've written myself, or mastering it, or through association with my contemporaries. So there's a lot of familiar stuff. There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of my history in there. But beyond that, I actually see this collection as a bit of a fossil record for the format. You can see the developmental arc of compact discs and their accessibility to individual users. In the early 80s, this compact disc was first made available commercially in 1982. In the 80s, there's very little local content, independent local content particularly. And as the price of production came down, became more accessible, there's a lot more independent releases. So towards the very end of the 80s and the very early 90s, there's a real big boom of local productions on compact discs, replicated compact discs, that is. And you can see this exactly the same sort of arc with recordable CDs. In the very early 90s, when they were first became available, the equipment was hellishly expensive. It was the Ferrari kind of bit of audio kit. I believe a single writer was sort of in the order of about $40,000 Australian. So that's sort of halfway to a house in terms of... I wasn't buying houses back then, so... so, you know, they were prohibitively expensive and they weren't there weren't very many of them around. So there's very little independent... There's very little material within our collection that are on recordable discs in that early part. But as that price came down towards the end of the 90s and the early 2000s, to the point where they became ubiquitous, most computers had writers in them, the amount of independent releases in the collection start almost outweighing the replicated discs. To the point where there's a bit of a period where all of that demo stuff, the homebrew recordings, they're all CDRs. And they all tend to be CDRs on budget discs and, you know, written on who knows what kind of writer. So there's a real variability with their quality. And towards the end of the 2000s, file sharing and social media starts becoming available. And there's a drop-off in both replicated and CDRs in the collection of published material, because those independent artists, the backyarders, the homebrewers, no longer felt necessary to publish with a physical item. They would do it online. And that's, for me, probably that first signal of another dying format. And for a key cultural institution like ours, it really does mark that perfect timing to implement a large-scale reformatting program before it's too late.
Peter said it at the commencement of his talk that he was worried that his talk didn't quite fit with what was going on. I'm sitting there, my stomach is ulcerating because I know that I've got over 2,000 CDs and CDRs sitting in my collection and they're just rotting away as I'm sitting here. Fortunately, Bruce Springsteen's going to live on forever, so I suspect his discs can go to God. Now, there's a disc worth saving. I think, and perhaps we'll talk about this in the panel session a bit more, but I think the interesting thing for us is that we acquired a great deal of those discs, and I'm sure it will be similar for you. We acquired them from artists, struggling artists, and typically they are not high-quality discs. They're not, they were bought on Victoria Street as a 100 spindle bundle for $24, so even more vulnerable than perhaps some of the brand name ones.